You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
Jim Brown, former Secretary of State, former Insurance Commissioner, former State Senator, all-around observer of Louisiana and life in Louisiana, has been on our store, on our show twice before. This will be obviously his third appearance, but he is so versatile in his perspective and his mind works in so many ways that you can have him many times, each time on a different topic. And he has a book out called My Louisiana Odyssey, a memoir, which just goes all over the place. We have really interesting stories about his career. A lot of it deals with politics. A lot of it deals with personal interactions. And you can just learn a lot by reading this book. So, Jim, is the book out now? Can it be, is it in bookstores?
Errol, of course, Amazon in this day and age. I wish there were more bookstores. Garden District Bookstore. Does a brisk sale of my books and Amazon and my website, which is thelisbonpress.com, that published the book. But it's been out about a year. And what the purpose behind the book is, Errol, that I felt like that there have been some great biographies and great stories written about political figures and other in the state of Louisiana, primarily in Louisiana, but that I was unique in having a lot of firsthand knowledge. Our friend John McGinnis wrote some marvelous books, but it's really secondhand knowledge. I had firsthand knowledge and was in the catbird seat of a number of major events that took place between governors and presidents and other people when I was a state senator. And I wanted to tell all those stories to keep them down. And, you know, I'm a history buff. I've taught history at both LSU and Tulane. And I also have written extensively about Louisiana history. And so I wanted to capture all this, number one, to have it available. I built the state archives when I was Secretary of State and wanted to capture so much of the documents that we lose. And then I also had a second version. I felt like my life was, hopefully people will feel unique, but at least interesting. And I've got seven grandkids, and I didn't want them just to hear second or third hand about what their grandfather or great grandfather did in his life. I wanted to be able to read it firsthand from me. You'll notice my book is dedicated to my seven grandkids.
Oh, yeah.
And so as a consequence, there was multi-purposes in writing the book just to get my story out.
Okay. Well, we're going to try to touch on some of those stories. It'll be impossible to get on, but first, when you mentioned John McGinnis, who I knew and admired, and I thought had he wanted to, could have been a national level political commentator, had a good wit to him. But one of my favorite quotes of his was about the legislature. And he says, the legislature could have done less, but it ran out of time. Okay. So anyway, before we run out of time, though, let's talk. First, something has to do with none of this, but I just thought it was interesting. You did a column a few months ago about the night that Garth Brooks performed at LSU. And I thought your story about him, and this is a stadium that seats 100,000 people. And was it full that night?
102,000 people, and there were people couldn't go online to buy tickets. It was the second largest outdoor concert in the history of concerts like that, I'm told. And so it was quite an evening of a major star worldwide that I had some personal experiences with.
Now, of course, there's a personal affection for him in Baton Rouge, especially in Tiger Stadium with his song about Baton Rouge. They play that during the LSU games and the crowd goes nuts. And I'm sure the same thing happened there.
They all went nuts. And of course, after the song was over, then everybody started hollering, LSU, LSU. So it's a magic moment. And he has said on several occasions that that's his favorite song of all the songs that he's done. And from Megastar, that's a great tribute to LSU and Baton Rouge and the sense of our understanding great music and appreciating it.
Well, it's a powerful song, the way it starts and it keeps on going. But you also, in that column, talked about many years before the first time you encountered Garth Brooks. Could you tell about that?
Well, I had just been elected Secretary of State, and I remember the Kentwood Chamber of Commerce asked me to come up on a Saturday night to swear in their officers and be their principal speaker. This is back 1983, maybe. And so I drove up there with myself, and if you don't know where Kentwood is, it's right in the Mississippi line on I-59, just as you go into Mississippi. So I went up to Kentwood, swore him in, and I started to head back home. And I took a backward path that a little bit more pleasant drive. It didn't have the interstate traffic. Stopped at the Bear Creek Western Saloon and Restaurant. And it was a local watering hole and place to eat for the locals up in the Greensburg area. So it was about halfway home. I stopped off just to maybe get a bite to eat. I hadn't eaten dinner and drink a cold beer. And there was about 30 people in the bar, Errol, and a guy was singing. He had a net in front of him because some of the drunk fellows would throw beer bottles at him. So that typical in Louisiana bars. And nobody was paying attention to him. There was carrying on in the bar above the 30 people there. And I sat there at the bar and listened. I've always liked to play a guitar and banjo and always liked to hear good country music, outlaw music. And so I listened for about 30 minutes. It was time to go. And I asked the bartender, I said, "Billy, who is that fella? He's got a pretty good voice. No one's listening to him, but I kind of liked enjoying him. Who is he?" And he says, "Well, he comes over here from Oklahoma every few months." He said, hey, Johnny, who's that fella that's singing right there?" And the guy says, "Let's see. His name is Brooks, Garth Brooks." And I said, "Oh, well, I like him." And I put a couple of dollars in the tip jar. And I said, "You know, he just might make it big one of these days." And drove on home to his top song, Baton Rouge. I headed home to Baton Rouge. So interesting, from 1983 to today, the transmission of the whole change of Garth Brooks, what a superstar he is today. And I heard him when he was very a blimp on the screen where no one was appreciating him.
Well, they say that part of his brilliance as a performer is that he puts on such a good concert. He puts on a good visual show.
Yeah, he says, "I can't believe people pay me money to do what I just enjoy doing. This is my what I like this better than anything else." And I understand when he had a press conference. When he came in, he went around to every member of the press and shook their hand, asked them where they were from, and something that most entertainers don't do. He's a very special guy, and we're glad that he's written about Louisiana and seems to love our state so much.
And then another great song is "I've Got Friends in Low Places." I mean, the crowd just goes crazy with that. And it's a fun song to listen to.
Well, my favorite song is the song he wrote called "The Dance," and it reflects, we're going to talk, I think you say, a little later on about some of my legal confrontations with the federal government. And I had a reporter ask me at one point in time, was it all worth it? You were in public all this time. You had all these confrontations. You had the highs and the lows. Was it worth it? And I said, and I quoted Garth Brooks, "Life's better left to chance. I might have missed the pain, but I would have had to miss the dance."
With a beautiful line.
That line. And that kind of sums up my philosophy towards life there, Errol.
Yeah, it's a great song. It's a very moving song. Well, as long as we're touching on country music, you know, we always have our tradition of having a couple of segments here. You're from Faraday. You grew up, like 14 years you spent in Faraday? Was that? And you were elected to the legislature from there. But you were born in Kansas, is that correct?
I was born in Kansas City, Missouri, then went to my dad was to the Kansas City Southern Railroad. And so then he was transferred to St. Louis, graduated from high school in St. Louis. And then eventually what kept me in Louisiana was going to Tulane Law School. And it was by hook or crook. I'd never been to Louisiana, never stepped foot in it. And I had gone to the University of Southern California, got admitted to law school there. and was going to, I was hoping to make the Olympic team. I was a pretty successful track runner back in hurdler and sprinter in my day. And so I moved out there to train to make the Olympics. But when I got to law school, it was a bunch of Southern California boys learning Southern California law. I didn't like it. Well, the only school who had not started yet that had accepted me was Tulane. I didn't know anything about it. The only thing I knew was Walker Percy. I'd read The Moviegoer, and Dr. Percy, our probably the finest author that's ever come out of Louisiana, had edited the North Carolina newspaper where I was an undergraduate, and I wrote for the North Carolina newspaper, so I heard a lot about him. That was my only tie to Louisiana. So I came to Tulane cold, graduated from law school, married a girl from up in the Faraday area, and that's what got me up there, Earl. Just kind of, I came in kind of cold, a Yankee kind of slipping in to all the rednecks up there is what it was, and must have been pretty successful at it because about a few years after I was there, I got elected to the state Senate, as you pointed out.
Yeah, Faraday was probably a perfect setting for it. But now that you mention Walter Percy, you tell a little story about Walter Percy. When he applied, was it for school, and he wasn't accepted because of a trial paragraph he had to write?
Well, he was trying to get into the advanced English program when he was a freshman at North Carolina, and so he had to write an essay to see if he would qualify. And he just read William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury. I think a good bit of it was written in the French Quarter in New Orleans. And so he wrote about a three-page stream of consciousness, something like what Faulkner did in The Sound of the Fury. And he was very proud of it. He submitted it, and they put him in the rehabilitation class because they thought he couldn't handle college writing. So he was put down to the lower level.
So Faulkner would be known for his, people will get his long sentences. He'd have long, long rambling sentences, which wouldn't meet anybody's standards except for him. And I guess that's the right faculty in North Carolina.
Great fella. And I knew him before he died. And he called me up one day and said, I see you're running for governor of Louisiana. He said, I like your ideas, like your philosophy. I want to urge you on. I'm going to vote for you. And I had coffee with him on several occasions. And I've gone over to visit his gravesite over in Covington at a monastery over there. And so I wish I would have had more time to spend with him in his later years.
I remember at one time when the state established what we call the Bessie Board, the Board of Elementary and Secondary Education. And there gets to be some people appointed by the board. And he was appointed to be a member of that board. And everybody thought, what a great idea, having this scholarly intellectual man. And he was lost. That was a world he's not used to, getting into elite politics. So he kind of quickly resigned.
Different world for him, right? He just liked living in the rural part of over in Covington, Louisiana. And but he sure could produce some marvelous work. I'll tell you, I have read and reread so many of his novels. And so a great Louisianian that we're very lucky to have from our state.
Well, anyway, back to Faraday for a second. You've told the story that when you were a young attorney, when you started off and you were in an office space in Faraday, you didn't have a secretary at first. So you're just sitting there one day, like I guess it was your opening day, and the person who proved to be your first customer came in.
And that's right. give you a little backstory. Now, back when I was in St. Louis 10 years earlier, almost to the day, number one song in the country was Jerry Lee Lewis singing Whole Lot of Shaking Going On. Come on over, baby, whole lot of shaking going on. And all my girlfriend and I would dance and dance to the sock hops on Friday night to that song. We loved it. Fast forward 10 years, now I'm now the sole practitioner, didn't have any clients, didn't know anybody in Faraday, had a little bitty law office, put my shingle out. And I'm there one day and I'm in the back room and the door opens and I look around the corner. And someone's saying, where's Lawyer Brown? I need me a lawyer. And I looked around, and there was the killer himself, Jerry Lee Lewis, that wavy hair back there. I recognized him immediately. And he had some ne'er-do-well clients who are, I think, some brother-in-law and a nephew got in jail hunting birds out of season. And so anyway, I became his lawyer, and he would call on me every now and then over about 30 years. never paid me a fee, but I could always get good seats to any of his concerts when he was down here in the South there, Errol.
Do you still have contact with him or?
Not, probably been 20 years since I've talked to him. He's not in good health. He was, I'd called and arranged a concert for, tell you his influence. No one knows his influence. I'm in New York City at a roast for a relative of mine. And probably the wealthiest Republican donor in the country, a guy named Paul Singer, was there at the roast. He's given millions and millions every year to Republicans. So, and everybody knows who Paul Singer is. So I never met him, and I'm sitting at my table and I see him walk. I recognize him. He's walking over and he stopped at my table. He says, "Are you Jim Brown?" I said, "Yes, sir, I am, Mr. Singer." He said, "I understand you know Jerry Lee Lewis." I said, "That's right." He says, "You know what I do? I got a piano in my office. When I want to take a break from my work, I sit down and do a boogie-woogie piano, just like Jerry Lee."
Oh, okay. So,
and Jerry Lee was booked in New York City to perform, and I was going to get him together. But then he had a number of health problems. Now he's 85, living up in Nashville, and not in real good health. So,
well, just to show how prophetic we are, if anybody, I said prophetic, not pathetic, okay. If anybody wants to hear a little bit about what that boogie-woogie piano sounds like, here's a little bit of Great Balls of Fire. Same thing. You can get the same feeling.
That's right. That's right.
You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain. Too much love drives a man insane. You broke my will, but what a thrill. Goodness and gracious, great balls of fire. I like the duck of water, thought it was funny. You came along and moved me, honey. I changed my mind. This love is fine. Goodness gracious, great balls of fire.
Quite a performer. And then he led me, actually. He then put the word out. I was a pretty good lawyer, and he brought me Jimmy Swaggart. I represented the Swaggart family. And then I also represented Mickey Gilley, who was the country singer of the year. And so I had all three cousins in my little office, and the word got around, and really it really helped my law office tremendously up there in Faraday.
Well, as it happens, Mickey Gilley, had a great song called Room Full of Roses. So really, it's a beautiful, in the genre of country music, it's really a beautiful song. And here's a little, so this would be Jerry Lee's cousin. And Mickey Gilley, this is like the old thing of a guitar, the guy's standing by a microphone with a guitar and singing, whereas Jerry Lee is kind of like dancing around on the piano. But here's a little bit of Mickey Gilley and Room Full of Roses.
If I sent a rose to you, how every time you make me blue, you'd have a room full of roses. And if I sent a rose of white, for every time I cried all night, you'd have.
Yeah, he wasn't the rock and roller of Lewis. He would play some my country flavor songs. He died about a month ago, and I know I was very fond of Mickey. We got together fairly regular, and he did two concerts. He would come and perform for fundraisers for me, and was helping in my campaigns for state senator primarily and for secretary of state, and just a wonderful fellow. Wrote his own club up in Branson, Missouri. And like I say, died about a month and a half ago, I guess. We're going to miss him. He's a wonderful Louisianian.
Yeah, that's a nice song. You know, sometimes like you hear a song and then it kind of reverberates in your mind, like the rest of the day. The day I was going over this music and we picked that whole night, just like Room Full of Roses, that line was just bouncing around my mind, you know, so it's the,
My favorite song of his is "The Girls, They All Get Prettier at Closing Time." He laughed whenever he'd do concerts. I was there. He said, "Let me play Jim Brown's favorite song for you."
That's a pure country sort of title, if I've heard one. In your book, again, there's a lot of different stories there, but you talk about the presidents and just about every president, I mean, in recent years, you've had some sort of interaction with. Is there any president that stands out, like your favorite or your least favorite? Or?
Well, the guy that I had the most in a relationship, it was Bill Clinton. I'd met Clinton as Secretary of State, years back with a bunch of Secretary of States. You wouldn't remember that, but when I was elected insurance commissioner on election night, it was about midnight, and I was leaving with all my group had split away. I'd won the election. I had my son over my shoulder. I was walking out the door of a restaurant where my victory party was, Errol, and the owner said, "Hey, there's a telephone call for you, Jim." I said, "Look, it's the press. I've just had a full night. I'll just take a number and I'll call him later." He says, "Well, it's the governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton." So I picked up the phone. He said, "Jim, I just want to congratulate you. I just got the news you were elected insurance commissioner." I said, "Well, thank you, governor. I appreciate that." We chatted for about 10 minutes. Well, that wasn't just me. That's what Clinton did. You know, he'd get a friend of mine, Tommy Hudson, who was handling his business in Louisiana, probably sent up 8 or 9 telephone numbers. And Clinton would stay up there to the wee hours calling people, congratulating him. But I was very impressed with that. And so then I met him when he was in the White House, because I was in office when he'd fly into Louisiana. I'd always be there to greet him as the other state officials would. And then he was to speak for re-election. The election was on Tuesday, Errol, and this was a Friday night in New Orleans. They're on the riverfront, Wolfenberg Park. And there were several thousand people there to greet him as he made a campaign pitch. Well, back then, this was 1996. I don't know the circumstances, but the governor and the lieutenant governor are both out of the state. And so they asked me, would I introduce him? And I was, you know, tickled to death to introduce him. So I introduced him. He's going to be easily reelected the following Tuesday. And so after his speech, he fired up the crowd, and we had a little holding area. Senator John Breaux was there. There was a tent, and he stayed there in the holding area and kept working the crowd. And he went around 3 or 4 times shaking hands. And, you know, well, my wife had planned a dinner party in Baton Rouge. We had a big group for dinner. And I said, "Look, I'll be home for the dinner party. I'll introduce the president, come right home." Well, it was getting later and later. And so finally he came back over for the third time. Says, "Jim, is there anything else you think I can do?" I said, "Yes, sir, there is, Mr. President. Would you get the heck out of here so I can go keep my wife from being too mad at me about the dinner party?" And he left and off he went. So, so in any event, he was the one that I knew the best. And quite frankly, if you look at the economy today, whether you liked his personal life or not, the economy sure was good, and life for us was good. We were at peace, stock market up, full unemployment, pretty good times. Again, whether you personally liked him, the Democrat or Republican. So that was the president that I probably had the closest relationship with.
You know, my take on the Clinton administration, I think it started off kind of wobbly. He got all involved in this, like, gays in the military stuff, which now that's a common issue, but back then that was very, very controversial. And he was a new president, and why are you worried about this? There's so much else to worry about that. And with his healthcare reform, with putting Hillary in charge, that wasn't working out too well. But I think, I mean, it's a tragedy, but Oklahoma City put him on the map in a sense, because it really made him be presidential. You know, it really established him. He went down to Oklahoma City, and we weren't as used to these kind of tragedies as, as it would be. But I thought he handled that really, really well, and it really started doing better as a president.
Well, the other thing is he was smart enough to say, "Look, if I'm going to get anything done and have my legacy, I've got to get along with this Republican Congress." And here Newt Gingrich is trying to impeach him, yet he's calling him at 11 o'clock at night to talk over the budget information. So, you know, most presidents would never do something like that. So, you know, he realized that he was going to have to get something done. He was going to have to get along with the Republican administration, and he did so. So you got to hand it to him. He was a darn good politician. No doubt about it.
And apparently, even at the most basic level, I never experienced this, but I've heard about it, that if you were the vent and he would meet you, that when he shook hands with you, one, he held your hand firmly and he looked directly into your eyes. I mean, he really made personal contact with you. I mean, he really left you with a feeling when he met you.
You had to see him on a receiving line. I was in several receiving lines with him. And he would, as you say, you thought when you were shaking his hand and talking to him, there was no one else in the room. His whole focus was understanding you and greeting you and nothing else. It was just tunnel vision almost. And he was very, very good about that. Edwin Edwards is awfully good at that. Very personal. He was awfully good at that personal one-on-one touch, but Clinton was the best, hands down, hands down.
To the contrary, and look, Lindy Boggs was a very sweet woman. I liked her. I think she did a lot good, but she wasn't good at that sort of thing. Okay? And I remember one time there was some event. I think I met her three times that night, and each time it was like, "Hi, I'm Lindy Boggs." It was like, you know, she didn't meet like, she didn't remember from the first time to the next time. What was Richard Nixon like?
Well, he was an interesting guy. I think he's underrated. I think he was a good president. If Watergate had not stained his legacy, I think that he would have gone down in his history as one of our most competent presidents, particularly in foreign relations. I met him. I was president of the Tulane Law School, Errol. And we had a speakers program, or we would have several speakers throughout the year. And he had been defeated for president by John Kennedy in a very contested election, then lost the governorship of California, but started to get a little comeback. And there were some rumors he might run for president again in the coming election in 1968. And so, I just took a chance and wrote him a letter and I said, "I'm the president of the Tulane Law School. Would you consider coming and being our speaker at our special law day? We'll have a large crowd there." And lo and behold, I heard back from an aide saying, "Yeah, he'll come. He's going to come." He was looking for a reason to come to Louisiana, and he had a big fundraiser. They went ahead and planned a big fundraiser that evening. The Governor Dave Train, who was then a congressman, was involved in. But in any event, Nixon came and I introduced him. He was very gracious and, again, very personal, asked questions about my career. And he said, "You ought to come on and work on my, you know, do some things for me." And his aide wanted me to head up young voters for Nixon up in New Hampshire, young Americans for Nixon, I know. And so I said, no, I was going to stay in Louisiana. But he was a very personal guy, and like I say, underrated because of the Watergate scandal. I think, as I mentioned, foreign policy, he was a solid president that opened up this, our relationship with China and was very respected throughout the world and kept America at peace once that Vietnam War got beyond us. So I like Nixon. I liked him a lot.
It's like Lyndon Johnson with Vietnam. You know, if it weren't for Vietnam, I think, Johnson would have been well respected.
Very much so. I think he was very torn about Vietnam and as to what to do. He came in, you know, he was the mastermind of the Senate, but he didn't have much foreign relations experience. You know, he was running the details of the Senate. Yeah. And then he all of a sudden he becomes president. And so And that was, I don't know how any president would have handled something like very, very difficult problem. I never met Lyndon. Well, I met him in crowds, but I never had any personal relationship. But his wife, Lady Bird Johnson, came to my mother-in-law's house up in Natchez across from the river from Faraday. And I had a delightful 3-hour meal with her and just a marvelous woman who gave a lot of insights into her husband and all the trouble that he was going through. So, and I think that's why he died at a younger age, because he was torn over Vietnam.
Yeah, I guess we said, now that you mentioned your mother-in-law, you're married into the Solomon family, is that correct? That your wife is Solomon?
That's right, she is. Her dad was Teddy Solomon, who named one of the top 300 New Orleanians in the history of Louisiana, and had a large movie theater empire that he built. Was very successful at that, and he died here a few years back. But I'm married to one of his daughters. That's right.
Who's a twin?
That's a twin. Uh huh. In fact, I'm one of the twins back in the background. So we're, but she is a twin, and her husband was State Representative Steve Carter, who was a very popular legislator, kind of took the lead in educational issues, and very unfortunately passed away of the COVID here last year. So, but in any event, and I had the COVID very badly too, Harold. I was hospitalized for a couple of weeks, so I'm fully recovered, but I'll tell you, it's a terrible thing that's happened to so many of us.
You tell a story in the book that they, speaking of your wife and your sister-in-law, that you were running, I guess, I don't know which one you were running for, but you went to some kind of event and your wife was with you, but then you had another event and she was just tired and couldn't make it. So your sister-in-law went with you. So a lot of people said with your wife.
Wonderful thing about identical twins, I was running for governor. And of course, my wife was on her own giving speeches on my behalf and traveling the state and just, you know, obviously it was very, very tired. And so I finished one event with her, and then we had to go, I think, to Crowley to the Rice Festival. And she said, I just can't do it. I'm so exhausted. So I took the twin. I didn't introduce her as my wife, but of course everybody assumed it was because she was identical. So she was a great fill-in. It's great to have a twin to back you up there, Earl, I can tell you.
that's a fun story. You tell of a couple of times when you were Secretary of State that there was some sort of political need in both the governor and the lieutenant governor were out of town. And so you were acting governor. There was one time you called, he had to sign something by midnight. And could you tell about what it's like being an acting governor?
Well, on several occasions, I was notified that I was there, that under our constitution, you know, when the governor and lieutenant governor are out of town, rather out of the state, then you do become acting governor. The only crisis I ever had was when Dutch Moriel took over the buses in New Orleans and fired all the bus drivers and kind of took over the whole bus situation. There was a lot of violence that was threatened, and I was on call to maybe fly to New Orleans and call out the National Guard. And I stayed for about 3 days. It was very tense. And finally, Mayor Moriel solved that problem. But the other time, remember, once both of I think Bobby Freeman and Dave Treen were out of town, and the press, I got a number of calls. You're the governor. What are you going to do? I says, well, I mean, I could declare a national holiday, rather a state holiday. I could veto the budget was in session right now, but I just think I'll cook up a big pot of squirrel stew and invite all my friends and the press to coming up to my office. And that's what I did. I served, you know, I'd written a cookbook, Errol, the Jim Brown's world famous squirrel stew and other country recipes. So I got some friends of mine up in Faraday to gather up some squirrels, and I made a squirrel stew. That was the highlight of my being governor that day.
So if I go to Paris and I'd mention Jim Brown, they'd say, oh, yes, the squirrel stew. It's world famous.
Yeah, I'm still noted for that up there. So, and actually, it's pretty good. You know, I think if your listeners in New Orleans haven't experienced alligator and a variety of fish that you don't normally think about eating, and a cross-section of varmints, and I'll tell you one great story. It's a true story. I'd given a speech down in Jennerette, Louisiana, I think, when I was maybe insurance commissioner. And I was driving back home, and I stopped at a little country store to get a cold drink because of a very hot day. Well, there's a fellow up on the porch, and he had a great big pot. He was stirring up the pot. I said, what you cooking up there, brother? What you cooking? He says, I'm cooking me up a gumbo. And I said, what kind of a gumbo you cooking up? He says, I'm cooking me up a hawk gumbo. Of course, hawk's completely illegal to cook. And I says, what does a hawk gumbo taste like? He's about like an owl gumbo. So up, you're living up in Faraday. I mean, you, of course, deer meat's a staple, but I've tried about every varmint you could think of if you got time to lead me into a Jimmy Davis story about cooking up in my school recipe, Governor Davis, who, and by the way, if you Google the most popular American song worldwide, it's "You Are My Sunshine," written by Jimmy Davis. And so Davis had a farm up in Newellton, Louisiana, and he would drive back and forth from Baton Rouge to Newellton after he was no longer a governor, but he had a house right by the governor's mansion. Well, he was a little older and needed a break. And so he walked in my office one day. I'd never met him. And he said, "Brother Brown, you're right on the route coming down to Baton Rouge. I need me a couple of things. I need me to use your bathroom. I need a good cup of coffee." So, "Governor, come on in." And so he made this a regular stop over like 25 years. Every few months when I was practicing law, at least, Governor Davis would come in. Well, one day he said, "Would you notarize something for me?" And I said, "Sure, I'll be glad to, Governor." And I notarized a document for him. And he said, "Now, what owe you, Brother Brown?" I said, "You don't owe me nothing, Governor. I'm glad to do it." And I became the official Governor Jimmy Davis notary. Wow. This went on when I was Secretary of State, Insurance Commissioner. His aide, Chris Fazer, would call and say, "Governor needs something notarized." And I'd go over to his house and notarize it for it. We'd talk a little bit. And it became a good friend and always supported me when I ran. Well, Errol, a few weeks before he died, Chris Fazer, his aide, came to my office. I was over at the insurance building in Baton Rouge. Said, "Jim, the governor's not doing well at all, but he wants you to notarize his last will and testament. And could you come over?" "Of course I will." And so he was sitting up there in bed, Errol, and you could tell he was very weak. And I notarized the document for him. And he said, "Brother Brown," he always called me Senator. He liked the Senator tone. I like Senator better than any of those other offices you had. He called me Senator. He said, "You've been doing this for me for I don't know how many years. Isn't there something I can do? You know I'm winding my life down. What could I do for anything I can do for you?" He says, "Governor, yes, there is. You can repay me for all the times I've notarized all those documents if you will do this. Here's what I want. I want a few bars of 'You Are My Sunshine.'" And he smiled and he kind of straightened up in bed. "The other night, dear, when I lay dreaming," and sang that whole first chorus of "You Are My Sunshine." So that was my payment for being the governor's notary all those years. And very touching, by the way. I've always thought that was a very moving moment when that happened. But one more thing about him. He would often ask, could you get me a coon? Could you get me a raccoon?" I says, "Governor, what do you want a raccoon for?" He says, "That's my favorite dish. I love to eat a raccoon." I said, "Well, Governor, how do you cook that raccoon?" He says, "You take that raccoon. Obviously, you cut off the musk and you skin it. You put it in a big pot of boiling water for about 10 hours. 10 hours you boil that raccoon. Then you take it out, you slice it little pieces, and you fry it. That's the best eating there possibly is, Jim, that raccoon." So I'd get my outlaw clients to bring in some raccoons and tell him, we'd put it in the freezer, and when he'd come by, I'd always have a raccoon for him. So he loved that raccoon. That's in the squirrel stew recipe.
So you had Jimmy Davis and Jerry Lee Lewis as clients. That's pretty impressive. Too bad they couldn't form a duet, you know, or a trio with you. You know, you and the banjo and Jimmy Davis on the singing and Jerry Lee on the piano.
Always by hook or just by luck, you know. I just happened to luck into those situations. I did come home one night. There's a little place called Fat's Bar, kind of right by my office in Faraday. And I'd come home one night when I was a senator and got home real late. My wife and kids were in bed, and I just peeked in the office to see for messages. And I thought, just to kind of wind down, I'd walk next door and see Fat's. The bar was open. Nobody was in the bar. So I sat there and tacked with Fats a little bit. Then I'm getting ready to leave, and the door opens, and Mickey Gilley comes in. And we visited for a while, and he sat down at the piano. And about 30 minutes later, Jerry Lee Lewis comes in. And Mickey and Jerry Lee sat down there at the piano swapping songs and telling stories. What I would have given for a tape recorder of that night. Wow. Yep. We stayed there probably 3 o'clock in the morning, just swapping stories and singing songs.
What a special night. You have a chapter in your book, and it's called Revenge. So that title right there implies, uh-oh, something happened. And there was a bump in your career. You want to talk about that and what led to this need to comment on revenge?
Well, I've got a new book coming out in about a month that goes into great, great detail about the sense of revenge, and I tie it into religion. This events, some of your listeners may not know that back in 1999, I was charged by the FBI with making false statements to an FBI agent. Edwin Edwards is involved. It's a long story. I won't go into it. But the bottom line is that I got convicted of making a handful of false statements. I was charged with all kinds of false statements. I mainly ended up with 4 counts. And so I had to spend 6 months at a nice little workout facility up in Oakdale, Louisiana, federal prison. I spent 6 months up there. Got in the best shape of my life. And wrote a book while I was up there, read 125 books during the 6 months. You know, some people go to a health club and pay a lot of money that I got for free, Earl, except for the honor. So I was pretty bitter about that. And as time has gone by, the prosecutor, the U.S. attorney in New Orleans who brought these charges has been disbarred, cannot practice law anymore. The other U.S. attorney has been humiliated, investigated as being a drug dealer, and the whole thing collapsed. Then finally, I won't go into detail, but the evidence that I lied was overturned several years later when the information came forward that they were the ones making the false statements, not me. Well, I was pretty bitter about this because, you know, I'd run for governor. I'd served in a number of statewide offices. And here at the height of my career, this terrible thing happened to me. And so I know the story. Maria Goretti is the youngest Catholic saint. I'm not Catholic, but I have some good friends that are priests, and I'm very close to the Catholic Church, even though I've not made any conversion. And I've often told the story of Maria Goretti. She was 12 years old, living in Italy, a small town in northern Italy. A next door neighbor came over one day while her parents were working the field. She's babysitting with her younger siblings. And he rapes her, and he takes a knife and puts 12 stab wounds in the little girl. Well, she lives for about 2 days, and on her deathbed, she says, "I forgive him, and I will see him in heaven and embrace him in heaven." It was such a magnanimous thing to do that she got sainthood. She's a saint in the Catholic Church. And so her remains, and I didn't know they did this, but the Pope authorized her remains to come to the United States and make several stops at Catholic churches throughout America. She was in Los Angeles, Denver, I believe, I think up in Cleveland, and she came to Baton Rouge. The Lady of Mercy Church in Baton Rouge. Well, her remains are there, and people came from all over the South to pay their respects and pass by the saint. I knew the priest there. He was a good friend of mine. And I called him and said, "You think there's any time at all that I could spend a little quiet time by myself with this Sister Maria Goretti, who I so admire?" "Yeah, Jim, that's going to be tough," he says. "You know, they have Vatican guards there, and it's going to be very difficult." But he did make arrangements to slip me in a side door, and I had some free time moments when the church closed with this saint. And I sat down next to Errol, and I put my hand on her coffin, or little box of her remains were in, and I prayed for my family, and I prayed for peace and the things we had all prayed for, and we're there with the saint. Then I got thinking, you know, these folks that did this to me, these terrible federal prosecutors that tried to destroy my life and now have reached their end, I've been so bitter about them. If this little saint can forgive what happened to her. Shouldn't I be big enough to forgive what these people did to me in the Justice Department? Shouldn't I be that big? She did it. What about me? I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I got up, and I started down the aisle and says, I'm not ready. I'm just not ready. And so I talked about it. I'm not making light of it. It's terrible what happened to her, but it's my story of dealing with revenge and what the good Lord would want me to do. And I haven't quite gotten to that point yet, Errol. Maybe one day I will, but I wrote it about in the book. And as of, I'm just not ready to make that line of forgiveness, quite frankly. You know, you stand by the river long enough and your enemy has come floating by. And I've seen the destruction of a lot of the folks that tried to bring me down, and their lives have been destroyed. And that hasn't bothered me, but maybe at one point in my life I will forgive, but not right now.
I can understand that. Have you ever happened to come face to face with any one of them since then?
I really haven't. No, I haven't. I saw the Saints game, one of the prosecutors in my case that was there. And as I walked by, said, "You're in my book. You ought to read my book. You're in my book." And that's all I said. But no, I just picked up the papers and watched the news and seen the come downs of the prosecutor, Eddie Jordan, and the assistant prosecutor, Sal Perricone, that handled my case, who's been disbarred, can't practice law anymore. And so any event, my new book will talk at length about them and what happened. But the focus of this book you're talking about was that, is there forgiveness? And there should be. We should forgive. But under the circumstances, I wasn't quite ready to forgive so far.
But at least you're giving it thought. You know, at least you're thinking. I mean, I can understand not forgiving. I really can. But at least you're dealing with it.
Yeah, well, I've dealt with it for 20. It's been 22 years now. And, you know, you can – and there's a, you can have some bitterness, but you've got to control that bitterness, Errol. I mean, I could have sat back and been bitter and kind of limped away in desolation or just gone off into oblivion. And I chose not to do so. After I wrote that first book, I spoke to civic clubs all over the state. It's very candid about what happened to me. In this book, I've done the same thing. I have built my law practice back. I have a publishing company that has published a number of very successful books. The Leo Honeycutt book about Edward Edwards is probably the biggest best-selling book by a Louisiana author in the history of the state. And I'm working on several more books right now. So anyway, I've not sat back in the sidelines and felt sorry for myself. I've bit the bullet and tried to rebuild my life and been very aggressive in doing so and very public about doing so also.
Well, you've had an amazing life, and just before we go, one thing I wanted to ask you is that, and I know you've still got a long way to go, too. You got a lot of stuff going on. What's the one big thing that you haven't done yet that you want to do?
Well, and that's a good question, and I've toyed with that. I'm 82 years old, so I think it's focusing back in on my family and doing things that constructively help. You know, one of the problems, politics takes a terrible toll on you. You're just not there a lot of times for your children. You want to be, and I would make extended efforts to be there, but I missed all. I was there for the big events, for the graduations and the ball games and that kind of thing. But you know, another word for love, you know, the word, how you spell the word love another way, T-I-M-E. Sitting there with your kids and watching a movie or just going out in the yard and peddling in the garden, just doing, going on out to the mall and just hanging out with your kids. The time element is what restricts you in politics. You make the big events. You're there. Oh, yes. And I'd get introduced. Hey, Secretary of State Jim Brown's here for his daughter when she did a dance recital. That's big stuff. But the things I missed was just hanging out, the time. And so it sounds like a minor thing, but it's not to me. Here now is hanging out with my grandkids. I've got two young grandkids that I take to school every morning and pick up most of the afternoons, and have taught them to swim, and they're on the soccer field for every game with them. I'm in New York City as we speak doing this video. I'm about to go to a bar mitzvah celebration for one of my grandsons. Last night I was with the other grandson, just sitting there watching his tennis practice, sat there for a couple of hours. I wasn't contributing or doing anything, but I just was there for him. And so I think the single thing I want to accomplish is being a little better father and grandfather, because politics took such a toll on me and on them, quite frankly. That'd be the single best thing I can tell you. I'm writing a new book. I've got a book that my next book is 800 pages. It's a little slow, evening read. You can read 800 pages where I review a number of things in my life. I've got coming out with. I'm trying to get in really good shape at 82. I'd like to get better shape than I've ever been. I'm working on that. So I'm dealing with some things along that line, publishing this book. I've got this be my seventh book. I've got an eighth one in mind I'm conceiving. I'd like to write one more book, be a first-rate grandfather. And I think that I can kind of consider that a full life and not worry about the future bring us, Errol.
It occurs to me that it's a rare person that can have a conversation with, in the same conversation, we talk about St. Maria Goretti and going to a bar mitzvah.
And I'm not Jewish and I'm not Catholic.
But I don't want to be remembered as the guy that made you late for the bar mitzvah, though. So anyway, thank you very much. It was delightful as always. So you don't know what the next book will be. Well, you got your book about the trial, but after that, you're just waiting. Maybe you'll
have this next book is a compilation of lots of stories I've not written yet. I review the whole trial that happened, the prison experience. I also write a lot of new material that I call my muse and me, my alter ego, the lady that shares my thoughts and my hopes and dreams, that communicates with me. And so I welcome my muse. Say, hey, welcome here. I've got lots to tell you. And I reviewed a number of things. I extended my thoughts on religion. I talked a lot about writing, what I've learned about writing, and how if you have a book and what you may want to write. I talk about some of my law cases that I thought would touch people's lives. So the muse and me goes through a good bit. And then I take some of my better columns and include that I've written. I've written over 1,000 columns. I've been writing starting back to 2003, I guess, when I first started, and well over 1,000 columns. So I put some of the better columns there, and it was kind of called the Jim Brown Reader. I want to make one final swan song. You know how you got the last picture show and the last samurai, all these the last concerts that these rock stars give. I'm going to make one more tour around the state starting in September. And I'm going to take about 3 months and work my way around my whole senatorial district and up to North Louisiana on the border, back to Shreveport, where visiting my parents' grave sites and some things that happened in my life with my family. Work myself down to New Orleans. Remember how I played my banjo at your father's mustache on Bourbon Street to get through law school. And kind of my last review of my love for Louisiana. Like I say, I'm not a native. This is my adopted state. And I have such fond memories. And I want to kind of capsulize my last swing, my last tour, if you will. And I'm hoping to do that starting in September. And that'll be, I'm sure that'll be the last book I'll want to put down.
Well, I think it's a great idea. The only thing I caution you is don't be too set on it being your last one. Keep the door open, so anyway.
Jim. Like I said, I'm 82 now, so, and there's a, writing is a real challenge. I had a long talk with my friend Rhonda Gray today, who's teaching a seminar up in Baton Rouge about writing. And, it's a big, huge commitment to write a book. And then once you write it, you're just about halfway through, because you've got to read and reread and rewrite. And you know this, look at all the writing that you've done. And then once you get it all done, it's got to be edited. It's got to be formatted. Okay, who's going to print this book? And then once you get the book printed, how do you distribute the book? We don't have bookstores anymore. You've just got a few in New Orleans, virtually none. And there's the last independent bookstore in Baton Rouge went out of business last month. We've got one Barnes & Noble, and that's it. So as a consequence, we've got one bookstore in Baton Rouge. I mean, that's unbelievable.
Is that Books A Million?
No, Books A Million went out of business several years ago. It's Barnes & Noble. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's some people that say Barnes & Noble won't be in business another 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. Amazon, by the way, I'm told, sells 85% of the hardbound and softbound books in our country today. Just unbelievable how they're dominant. I sell most of my books over Amazon or through the Lisbon Press. And now I do a lot of speaking. When I have books, I like to get out and talk about them. So I speak to lots of civic clubs. And if there's any civic club listening to me, well, give me a holler and I'll be glad to come speak to your group. And I sell a lot of books that way, too.
Sure.
I sell a lot of books when there's 60 people in the civic club, and most of the books I donate the proceeds to a particular charity, and I'll sell 40, 45 books. Well, at $25 a book, you know, you're doing pretty well. I do that 2 or 3 times a week. So, so I like to go out and get on the road and tell people about my books. So in any event, that'll be my next big challenge, and I'll be happy if I get one more under my belt.
Okay. Well, when it comes out, we'll talk about it. Okay.
Let me tell your folks that they could go to all the things I've talked about are on my website, which is simply jimbrownla.com. Very simple, jimbrownla.com. You can see the things I write and find some interesting commentary. I wrote one this week on the whole terrible problem over in Texas with those young kids that were killed. Just we'll finish one day on the relationship, the strained relationship between John McKithen and Edwin Edwards that I've never talked about before. So that'll be next week's column. All of it at jimbrownla.com.
Okay. Thank you. I'm anxious to read that. Thank you very much, Jim.
Take care. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.